This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This is iFanboy Pick of the Week, number 685, brought to you by Mack Weldon. For 20% off your first order, visit mackweldon.com and enter promo code iFanboy at checkout. And iFanboy listeners just like you. Welcome to iFanboy Pick of the Week. This is episode 685. I am Josh Flanagan. I'm here with my co-host, Connor Kilpatrick.
You're very pleasant with your hey.
I looked at it, it said hello, and I was like, I'm not feeling hello, so I decided to make it sound more like
hey.
Me.
Hey.
Hey.
Hey, everybody.
Did I crack?
No, but just you were just very, it was just like a children's, it was great.
Well, I'm supposed to read to my my five-year-old's preschool class on Monday morning. I have to read them a story because I volunteered. Which is a whole thing because I have to pick something out that lets me do a lot of voices.
Is he going to be embarrassed?
Are you kidding me? He was lobbying for it.
Okay.
He's five. No, I'm a dad who does those things apparently.
Okay. All right.
All right. We're iFanboy. We share. Sometimes at the wrong time. Every week we read our stack of comics, which isn't really a stack anymore. It's a digital file system, if we're going to be honest about it.
It's a digital stack.
It is, but even that's metaphorical. One of us picks their favorite book of the week. We call that the pick of the week if we ever finish all of these 60 to 80 page books that come out in a given week that should, by all rights, have been a light week and then turned out not to be.
Right.
We talk about that book, other books from the week, the patron pick, and if we have time, we'll read some listener mail or answer questions or share our thoughts on things which you have asked us to share them on. It should be a good time. There should be some rollicking. I don't know what that word actually means now that I think about it.
Rollicking?
I mean, I understand the context of it, but using it out of just saying a rollicking time, like...
It's like a partying, you know, it's a wild partying time. Uh-huh. Rollicking.
Uh-huh. Rollicking. Like, can you go a rollicking?
I don't know. It's not like rogering, but it's you could probably have a rogering and a rollicking time.
I don't want to be rogered. Here's your spoiler warning. If you haven't read your books, you will be rogered. So we recommend that you have yourself a rollicking good time reading them to avoid said rogering. Connor, you had the pick this week.
I did, and as you alluded to just a few seconds ago, it was a weird week because it was a fifth week. Normally a fifth week is really small, and as much as we love reading comics, it's always a little bit of a blessing here because we have a short time frame in which to read and record. But DC decided to put out all of their major books and then, for good measure, basically double the size of everything else they put out. And then Marvel dumped a bunch of War of the Realms stuff. So it ended up being, for me, just a regular-sized week, with actually longer books. So it felt like a bigger week than normal, even though it was a fifth week. So that was fun.
What happened to me is that I had planned, I was very responsible. I started reading early on Wednesday night, you know, and I was like, all right, I think I got a handle on these, and I had to go to sleep, and I'd left a few. But everything I left was huge, so I was up all night last night finishing. Mm. And this is not interesting content.
I just remember the feeling of I laid on my bed, I opened up a book we're going to talk about in a second, Superman Leviathan Rising Special. I tapped the screen to see how many pages, and I was like, 87?
Yeah.
Or whatever it was. All right. Well, we'll get to that in a second. Pick of the week was Doomsday Clock number 10. Jeff Johns, Gary Frank, Brad Anderson, Rob Lee. It was almost as if you took this book out of the context of the Doomsday Clock story, because I still don't really know what that is. But taken on its own as a 40-page book, I guess this was, whatever it was. This felt very much kind of like, and I'm probably projecting, but it felt very much kind of like Jeff Johns' middle finger to DC right now and where it's going. And it felt very Grant Morrison-y, in which, in this issue, Dr. Manhattan dives deep into the DC universe to figure out why it's so strange, why it keeps shifting and changing, and it becomes very metaphysical and meta-commentary on the nature of comics and how they keep getting rebooted and characters get rebooted and change and die and are reborn. And it became a very Grant Morrison-esque dissection of that, as well as an old Hollywood history book with Trader Vic's and Dan Tana's and the fire at Paramount in 1929, which was a real fire, and Hedy Lamarr and all the stuff I love in addition to comics. So it became very easy for me to make this the pick of the week, in addition to the delicious Gary Frank art. Again, I don't really understand this book. I've never understood this book from the very beginning in terms of what it is, what it means, and what it's trying to do. But this particular issue, I was all in on. I wrapped myself up in like a warm blanket in it. I just really liked the idea of examining how Superman is the sort of the linchpin of the DC universe and how his constantly being rebooted affects that world, changes it. You know, I like the sequence with his parents, how they keep finding him different ways and different times, different years, depending on when the comics were rebooted. I like how they made the new 52 Superman look extra stupid.
With the shine.
Yeah. And, you know, all the promise of that rebirth, you know, that brief rebirth special that ended up going nowhere with Wally West confronting Dr. Manhattan was great. And I also really like the saga of this actor, this closeted actor who, you know, shows up in Hollywood in the 20s as a teenager with no job, ends up starts as a delivery boy on Paramount's lot, ends up as a huge star, and it's all because of Dr. Manhattan. And I like that whole subplot. The brief appearance by the Justice Society was great. Mm-hmm. This was really terrific, as weird and as strange as this book is.
It's interesting. I think I had a different read on it than you did. I enjoyed it. I'll just put that up. This is not going to be that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't see it as a middle finger to DC as much.
No, I mean that's my own issue.
Well,
that's
right. I mean, projection. Like, I think like you are definitely sort of inserting your sort of subjective take on this and molding it, which is what you're supposed to do, by the way. You know, to me, it feels very self-reflective. I mean, obviously, like, I feel like I was going to say knowing Jeff Johns, but that's not knowing his work. I mean, mm-hmm. like he's a planner. Like he knows what he's going to do. So I don't think that this story necessarily changed through the course of it being published.
No, I don't think it did either.
Even though it feels as if, and I don't know, that the rest of DC changed. But that might have just been how long this took.
This first issue came out in 2017.
Yeah.
So I think that the direction DC was going in 2017 drastically changed in the intervening 18 months, and now the book is sort of irrelevant. And I don't know if that is affecting how they're making the book or not. But clearly it was going in a different way. In the intervening years, Jeff Johns got fired from the CCO position. Mm-hmm. Clearly something changed.
Mm-hmm.
How much it changed, I don't know. But this seemed like it was going to be a guidepost. You know, it takes place a year beyond the comics we're reading now, although it's silly because it's been almost 2 years since it started. But
5 years later.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense anymore. So now it's just become this sort of strange experiment that's beautiful.
Yeah.
And that's how I'm reading it. It's just this strange experiment that they're doing.
Well, it's interesting because in the sort of beginning of this one, I always do this. I have this twinge of, oh, he's going to just do this. I was going to say aping, but sort of heavy repetition of what Alan Moore did. And which is kind of what happened, where there's that issue. I don't remember what issue it was, but where John, you know, exists in all times at once and he's exploring, you know, quantum blah, 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 which I was in no way able to handle the first time I read it. And every time I've read it since then, I'm like, oh, my God, this is brilliant. Like, especially given when it was written. I feel like we understand more now that we did that. But that might just be me. But as I went on and the different things started happening and it pulled together. First of all, there's the story with the actor. And then you pull in this sort of comment on comics, you know, on the DC universe specifically, but also acknowledging that they're a I mean, like, it's self-referential. He's winking at the fact that, like, it's a comic universe. It's fictional. There's all these inconsistencies with it. I started to really enjoy that. And while it is taking off from what Alan Moore did, it's not just an impression at this point. There's other things that are bringing into it. I think that you're very spot on with your sort of Grant Morrison influence on this. Obviously, Grant Morrison was influenced by Alan Moore. And Geoff Johns is going to be a direct student of both of those people and a contemporary of Grant Morrison to a certain extent. He's both, really.
Yeah.
You know, once they got into that Superman stuff with all the different versions in this, you know, like it was swirling, like as you read it, you know, it's just and moving and you know, it is one of those things that if you don't understand, if you don't know Superman history to a relatively, you know, big extent, like it's not going to make any sense to you. So it's a really insular
or not as impactful. You just read it, you know.
Yeah, that's true. I'm sure that's the case with Watchmen itself. You know, if you were like a huge fan of those Charlton characters, you might really get more out of it. But either way, to appreciate it in sort of the way that that's all happening, I think it helps that we know that stuff and it makes it all the deeper. It was really enjoyable. It is almost like Watchmen in the same way, I think, that I'm not always sure what it's trying to say.
Yep.
And again, that's not a criticism. Like, I like that. Like, oh, it's saying something and I have to work at it. And what it's saying might change depending on what's going on when I read it. And I think that that's a big strength of work like this.
And also, ultimately, we're not – I mean, we have two more issues. Who knows when they're going to come out?
Yeah. Do you think this is officially late?
Yeah. They talked about
it. Or they planned like every 2 months or something.
No. It's been longer than 2 months. I mean, you've had 10 issues over the course of.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, they have said we apologize for the lateness. Because originally it did come out monthly for the first couple, which was just silly because, you know, Gary Frank can't.
You can't do this work like this in this.
But my point is ultimately we're not going to be able to judge this fully until it's done.
Yes.
Because right now, you look at it, you say, why did we spend 5 issues with those random characters, Punch and Jewel, and, you know, the joke? Like, why did we do that? So far, they disappeared from the story. They got killed. They don't mean anything. So, but maybe they come back, or maybe it becomes relevant later. We don't know. So ultimately, we can't judge the entirety of Doomsday Clock until we have the two more issues. All we can do is look at it as a piece of a whole, and as a piece, I found this utterly compelling. As you said, it sort of picked up a momentum and started swirling around your head as you got into his race through the DCU and the Justice Society and the Superman's reboots and even a little callback to his run on Action Comics. The momentum picked up really, really well. And in the beginning of this series, it felt more like the first issue especially felt like he was trying to do Alan Moore, specifically his voice, and it was not working. I remember. You weren't on that show, but I remember talking to Ryan about how we were both sort of shocked about how kind of clunky it was. But I think he's gone away from that as it's gone on. And while stylistically it's clearly Alan Moore influenced, I think it's he's not trying to do the staccato voice as much as he was originally. It's still there in the structure of the story, but not quite as much. Like the first issue was really glaringly like, I'm trying to do Alan Moore, and it wasn't really working because he's not Alan Moore. He's Geoff Johns. He's great for a whole entirely different reason.
It's weird because, you know, I really think he's doing a good job of this.
I think it's really well done.
Right. No, the point being, though, like, if you were to ask me, is Geoff Johns the guy who should be doing the Alan Moore thing? I'd be like, no. But I do think that he is the guy who probably understands it as well as anybody. So therefore, it makes him a good candidate.
And what's interesting is, you know, his comic work hasn't been super exciting for the last few years, as he has taken on a more corporate role at DC. The only other book he's writing right now is Shazam, and it's been fine. But it hasn't been, like, the Geoff Johns of 10 years ago, who was doing JSA and Superman and all these, you know, the books that were the most exciting books on the stands. But this book feels like that. And I don't know if this is like a Kurt Busiek Astro City thing where all of his creative energy sort of gets dumped into this one book and everything else. Yeah. You know, he's only got what's left for everything else. But this feels like old Geoff Johns, this book. And I know Gary Frank's a big part of that. It's one of the best looking books out there.
Yeah, I've always liked Gary Frank.
Yep.
I think not as much as you, but only because you really like Gary Frank.
I really like Gary Frank. He's my favorite artist, yeah.
But going through this, I forget that I'm not looking at Dave Gibbons sometimes. And I don't mean that he's aping. I just like he's captured. Whereas we were saying Geoff Johns can't necessarily do Alan Moore convincingly. Well, Gary Frank can channel Dave Gibbons convincingly.
Mm.
I mean, in sort of just evoking that style, that pacing, that there's a stillness to it.
Yes.
I think that so when it's not still, you know, it's that rigid grid really adds to that. Like it sort of makes everything metered and pacing, but it also allows you to break out of it when you do. And that, again, that swirling that we keep, which is really what it felt like, you know, that had a lot to do with the time jumping around, but also the art, like the characters gain excitement. Like it was like graphically paced really well. Like not like everything was calm and then got more heated and things were going around and it's very subtle and it just fits. It fits really well. It's one of those things where I'm losing words in sort of explain how the art works in this way, but it's something he's doing that's real good.
And I'll also add that while not excusing the lateness, because it's a planning thing, and also they should have known.
Yeah,
he's doing a lot of images per page. You know, it's not just 9 panels in some pages. The final page has 12 panels,
and it's a 38-page book.
He's doing almost more work than your normal page. So this takes a long time.
He absolutely is doing more work than your normal page. Like, there's no corners being cut here, much like Dave Gibbons. Like, there's guys who do monthly books, and you learn shortcuts. You learn ways to speed it up. I remember Darwin Cook saying to us one time, he's like, I learned to do it faster. But by doing that, that means it's a shortcut, and you can see it. See the difference in when he did New Frontier and then when he did, you know, stuff later, he got a lot more sparse. Frank Miller, same thing. They all do that in a way. But Gary Frank is not doing it here. And it's one of those things where you look at, you know, people's like best stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was the time before they knew to do that. And sometimes it works against them. Sometimes it works for them. But there is like something about the effort on the page you can see.
Yeah. He's putting all of it into this book.
Yes.
It's very impressive from a craft standpoint. We've talked about that with many books that we'll be talking about this week. Yeah, I really like this. I mean, this, again, it's not a commentary in the entire series. It's just commentary on this particular issue, which was, I thought, terrific. And for an old DC guy like me, it was a lot of fun to swirl back into a world that I guess is dead and gone. I don't know. It was a lot of fun to remember and look back and see. I just like comics are strange and weird and how they're reflected back into the pages themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun.
Yeah, with the people who sort of professionally have to think about them all the time.
Right. Another big book this week, Batman Last Night on Earth, number one. Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo, Jonathan Glapion, FCO Placencia, Tom Napolitano. This is the team from the Snyder Capullo Batman run. This is supposedly Snyder's final take on Batman. It's from the DC Black Label, which is such a silly thing.
This is the one that had the bat penis before?
No, that was Brian Azzarello. Which the second event never came out. This is the label, though.
Is that the Black Label, though?
Yes, that was the first Black Label book. They've slapped it on other books, you know, like, I think The Dark Knight Returns has it now. It's sort of like their prestige label. It's
also,
their Black Label.
Also, he said shit in this.
Right, so it's their prestige adult label.
There was one tiny swear in it, which seemed so out of place that it took me out of it completely. I was like, what's
yeah.
that doing?
And the thing is, like, I really liked it. Again, this is a strange sort of Elseworlds future tale, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
It's the take on the final act that they don't get to do in the regular book. So what does that mean? And this has been seeded through Snyder's previous run. You can take it as continuity if you want, or you can remove it if you want to. Snyder previously introduced the idea that, which is stupid and silly, and I don't really necessarily love it, that Bruce has a machine that will clone himself every generation, so there'll be a Bruce Wayne for Gotham for all time.
That's the ultimate exercise in narcissism.
Absolutely. And so here, Bruce Wayne wakes up in Arkham Asylum after this opening scene with a disturbing, creepy young dead body. He wakes up and he's got motor problems. He can't talk properly. His doctor looks like the Joker. The rest of the staff looks like the other rogues gallery. It's sort of like the end of Wizard of Oz. And then Alfred shows up and says, hey, you've been sick, but now you're awake. And then it's revealed that he's actually in the deep future. Alfred's an old man. And the world's gone to hell. The Justice League is basically dead. There's an underground group of Amazon superheroes that Wonder Woman leads that are going to escape to Gem World because the world at the surface is so terrible. Bruce decides to take action. And the grindhousey Snyder thing that he's been doing since Batman ended is that the Joker's head is in a jar, giving commentary as this is all going along. And it's weird and it's strange. And it's sort of a hybrid of Snyder's original Batman run plus what he's been doing lately. But I dug it. Well, for against all strange odds, I dug it.
I started it and thought, I don't want to read this. And again, I did a lot of thinking about... I find myself reluctant to say that something isn't good. And so I was trying to think, do I just not like this because I don't think it's good, or do I not think it's not for me? Because I think that's a fine line. Mm-hmm. I think that there's definitely some objective things you're like, I think this is not good. And then there's other things that, you know, I like Scott Snyder. I don't really like a lot of his Batman stuff, largely because he's definitely in a horror, psychological horror sort of mode, and I don't like that stuff. It's just not my thing.
He's turned it up since Batman ended.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. And it's funny because the stuff that I liked the best of his was sort of that early on, the jock Dick Grayson as Batman story, which was pretty straight up. And I was like, oh, this is working for me. It's fun. And then he got into all of the lore and the owls and the blah, 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 and all this stuff. And as we forgot, and then, you know, finally Metal.
Yeah.
And it's not my thing. I can't even speak to Metal being good or not. I don't know. Didn't seem good to me, but it's like trying to listen to a language you don't understand in the way. So as I was reading through this, I thought, I'm probably not going to like this. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, as a rule, find myself super interested in this future world and all this stuff that was going on. However, by the end, I was definitely intrigued by where the plot was. It made me curious enough about, like, why is Wonder Woman like this? This seems wrong. Mm-hmm. Not in a bad way, like it's like... like, what's the story behind all this? I really don't like the Joker head talking the whole time at all. That's a thing yeah. that I'm...
I would have put money on Vegas on that.
Yeah, no, that's not hard to figure out. But there were things in it where I got genuinely interested in sort of what the plot was. And I was like, okay, I'd like to see how this is going to play out. It was really good looking. I just put that like...
Yeah, I found myself really having missed how Capullo draws Batman. Yep. And those characters, Alfred, and, you know, this is also, much like Gary Frank, this is not a small undertaking. He's doing a lot here. He's drawing a lot of characters. This was 60-something, you know, almost 60 pages. He's doing all the major DC characters. It's a lot. You know, any artist will tell you the more characters you add, the longer it takes.
Yeah, and it's not half-assed in any way. I mean, Capullo and Glapion clearly work together. So, like, you know, by the end, I was definitely like, oh, there's definitely something here that's kind of cool. But I don't think I'm going to keep reading it.
Interesting.
You know, I'm interested to know who this new nemesis person is. Like,
I forgot about that. The bad guy's person named Nemesis, and they suspect it's one of his old proteges, and that sort of has a Armageddon 2001 vibe to it. I didn't love it, but I really enjoyed it because I do like these Hulk. Future imperfect kind of stories, Dark Knight Returns, like the end of the road for the character, and however you want to take it. Now, does this mean I'm putting it into my Batman continuity? Probably not. I'm probably just going to read it as an Elseworlds, and then that's totally fine. I'll just enjoy it that way. It's fun. I had a fun time reading it more than I actually didn't know what to think when I first started reading it. I was like, I don't know what this is going to be. I mean, I knew what Snyder said about it. I knew this is supposed to be his last take on Batman and it's Capullo, but. I didn't, and I knew about the head in the jar, but beyond that, I knew nothing, and I just was, you know, it was. I went in fresh, and so it hit a couple of buttons.
I went in skeptical, and then by the end, I was grooving with it. I was fine with it, but I kind of don't. It's not for me still. Like, I kind of don't care, but I came to the conclusion like it's not bad. Like, it was well done. I can totally say that. I'm not super interested in it. enough to keep reading, I guess. But if we were to come back here whenever in a month from now or 2 months and you were to be like, yeah, the second one was really good, I would read it. You know, I wouldn't be like, ugh, I'm not going to read that. I hate it.
Right. So I'm very curious what you thought of Heroes in Crisis number 9, the final issue. Tom King, Clayman, did all the art, although I was not convinced of that. I was a little surprised to see he was only the artist listed.
I don't know. I can't speak to that. I wasn't thinking about it. But let's just, you know, we'll believe the thing for now. I think, let's see. I think that I understood what the metaphor was by the end of it. And I think that if the point is to talk about post-traumatic stress and people who are trying to do good things, who are always trying to do the right thing and are under enormous stress from it, it causes them to make bad decisions. And it is reasonable to accept that if you are one of these superheroes and there's anything real about their psychology, that this is probably not far off the mark of something that might actually happen. Mm-hmm. I think that it's effective in that way. I think that they came up with a really good device at the end to make sure that Wally West isn't necessarily evil. Mm-hmm. Like, he didn't make a choice that seemed completely against his character, and the things that were done were justified. Was it ultimately satisfying to read as a superhero comic? I don't know.
I would agree with everything you said, except for the fact that I still don't think that what Wally did was in character, because his severe level of trauma has appeared nowhere else other than this book. However, what I'll say is my overall thought is similar to yours. The speech that Wally gives about why he did what he did, in which he's feeling so much pain and sadness and trauma, that if he revealed to the world that the superheroes feel the same way they do, that they're scared and they're sad and they hurt and they have anxiety and they have issues, and that they're going to get help for it, then, mm-hmm. then maybe everyone will feel like it's okay to go get help for whatever they're feeling, and then the world will be a better place. I totally get that. I can hear Tom saying it. I can hear his buddies from the war saying it. It rips my heart apart to yes. think about that. I don't want it anywhere near superheroes. It doesn't work within escapism. It doesn't work within this context that we're reading these books. I think ultimately this was an interesting exercise that will best be forgotten. And listen, there's no perfect writer. Sometimes the events don't work out. Brendis did Secret Invasion. We moved on. Then this doesn't diminish him as a writer. Now, this is not going to diminish Tom King as a writer.
I think it was a brave choice. I think there's a lot of things in here that I think it takes a lot of guts to do, to put on a page and try it. It's like one of the things in the end was like, I don't know that it was bad, but was it enjoyable?
No.
No, not really. You know, the sort of talking head pages got really ramped up by the end. And those were kind of funny and clever and interesting, but in a way almost out of place from the rest of it. Although, like, I get it.
They started to back up, which also, again, would never happen. If all their information got blown out into the world, they wouldn't start Sanctuary back up again. Mm-hmm. I liked the running gag of the different Robins throughout, you know, each one of them thinking they were the odd Robin out. That was a good bit.
Yep.
Other than Damian, because he's clearly a sociopath. Again, we've said it all the way through, so it's not surprising. I just don't think this works within the context of escapist superhero stories. It totally works within human stories. And again, I felt a very strong human emotion to Wally's speech because I can...
Yes.
You know...
Because you're human.
Knowing Tom King struggled with PTSD from the war, knowing so many soldiers struggle with PTSD through the war, I can hear humans saying this. I just can't hear superheroes saying it. That's why they're superheroes. And I get I'm going against what Wally's saying, but I don't think it works.
I think that...
That's just my own personal opinion. Also, I felt like one Wally was taller than the other Wally the whole time, and that was making me weird to me out.
In terms of what Wally would or wouldn't do, I mean, I think that I don't know where it happened. I think it was in the Flashbook where he got saddled with being part of a continuity where he remembered that he had a family in that rhythm part. I think that is your initial mistake right there. I think that was a bad choice for the character. They should have left that stuff in the past. The same way that if you were to bring up like the missing Peter Parker baby in Spider-Man, it would ruin Spider-Man.
Right.
And I think that that's what they did. Maybe it's because Wally didn't have his own book or wasn't considered to be a major character.
Or Zendaya was trying to destroy him.
Well, sorry. You know, I was going to say, like, this I was going to say the smacks of a Dan DiDio thing, but the fact is I don't really know what he does or what he's like.
Right.
I don't know. Like, I know. Like, he's a straw man for whoever's making that decision, whether it's one person or a group of people, you know, and what it does is it I was going to use the word tarnishes the legacy, but it changes the opinion that some people have of a character that shouldn't be that way. I feel like in the past there was probably a better venue for this than there is now, meaning that like in the long past, they would have put this in like a Vertigo book or something like that back when they did that kind of thing, or like labeled it Elseworlds almost.
Right.
But it seems to be in the middle of the continuity.
But also not, I mean, in the same way, it's not really your traditional crisis story in that he's not really bleeding.
But over in the Flash book, is Wally in jail now?
No. There's been no mention of him since he supposedly died.
Right.
Because we're back. We're also doing year one, so we're in the past.
So that works, though, with it. I mean, like, he went back. Some shit happens. He's in jail. We don't mention him. But I don't like that. Then what's going to happen, though, is that somebody's going to pick up on this at some point.
Right.
And when Wally was in jail, he'll go crazy and become a villain or something. You know, like something.
And it's not going to be as good because it won't be as authentic because Tom King is going through, you know, this. So it's.
Right. It's a really good. It will get diluted even further and be completely pointless because of some hack.
It'll be a parallax thing.
Yes, exactly. So I think it was kind of worth reading. Like, I enjoy talking about it and dissecting it. I enjoy trying to glean what of it is worthwhile because the writer has written so many other things that are worthwhile. But just think about what the change would be like if it was a different style artist or something like that. Like,
no, I liked looking at it a lot. I love the Clayman art. I love how the way it looked. And again, we've talked about it. I liked scenes of it. They were really good scenes. And much like we just talked about with Doomsday Clock, the craft is clearly there. It's a very high-level book.
Oh, sure.
It's just, I don't think it was a good idea, that's all. If it had been an Elseworlds book, you know, a slap, this outside story, kind of like Doomsday Clock is to me, then I might like it more, but to worry about the ramifications of it is I can't get out of the back of my head, and maybe there may be none. They may just forget about it.
Yeah, and I think that would be best. But it is one of those things where this is what we would say about Grant Morrison all the time is that he swings for the fences. Mm-hmm. They don't all hit. Now, we love Grant Morrison. We're still going to read his work. They don't all hit. And I think this is one of those ones that didn't hit.
Well, like I said, Bendis hasn't hit. You know,
yeah.
A lot of big writers go for big stories, and they don't always work. Sometimes they do. When they do, they're great, but they don't always work.
Yep.
So for about... I don't know how many minutes, but for a little while, Superman Leviathan Rising Special Number 1 could have been the pick of the week.
Okay.
For the first half of the book.
Sure.
First three quarters of the book. Nah, the first... What's between half and three quarters? Halfway through the Jimmy Olsen story.
Three-fifths. No, or five-eighths.
This 80-page behemoth is the special that kicks off the Leviathan story. It features a Superman story from Bendis and Yannick Paquette, a Lois Lane story from Greg Rucka and Mike Perkins, which is going to lead into a Lois Lane book, Jimmy Olsen story from Matt Fraction and Steve Lieber, which is going to lead into a Jimmy Olsen book, and Supergirl story by Mark Andreyko and Eduardo Spansica, which is going to lead it back into the Supergirl book. So this is sort of like your starting point for all the Superman books going forward. And those are the teams. Like, Rucka and Perkins are doing the Lois Lane book, and Fraction and Lieber are doing the Jimmy Olsen book. It was funny, because to open the credits page, it was like, oh, this is old Marvel. I love the Superman story. I love the Lois Lane story. I loved about half of Jimmy Olsen's story. Didn't care for the Supergirl story. But I like this whole thing. We've talked about Superman books, obviously, a ton. I'm enjoying this Leviathan story. I think the setup for it's fun. These villains are fun. Bendis still writes a terrific Clark Kent. His Clark Kent who gets kidnapped and is really bad at acting like he's kidnapped was funny. Mm-hmm.
Then the follow-up tag on that, which is like, oh, he's not acting, is he? Like, they all know.
Bruce is like, oh. There was a couple of strange things, like, so Talia al Ghul, the old head of Leviathan, shows up in this funky white dress, and then later on, Lois shows up wearing the same dress. It's never acknowledged. Never acknowledged or mentioned.
Yeah, and then she asks about Talia. I was like, well, why, if you don't know about her, why are you wearing her clothes? Which was super confusing. Like, I was like, wait, is Talia rescuing him?
Right, that's
Lois?
Once the cat started vomiting in the Jimmy Olsen story, that's when, for me, the book started faltering and it became less of a pick of the week contender. But that was strange. I was like, why did they originally draw it to be Talia? And then they realized it didn't work and they changed the dialogue? Like, it was strange to give her such a specific... It's not like a dress off the rack. It's a very strange dress. And so she shows, you know, Firestorm and Jimmy Olsen wearing a gorilla suit with the cat from Green Lantern, the Green Lantern Sinestro War.
I liked that bit because it meant that a lot of things had happened in the interim.
Right, right.
And then I noticed that, and I was like, oh, he's been through some shit, which I think is really funny.
That was funny. Just, it was the dress that threw me off. I was like, why is she wearing the same dress?
No, you're right. No, 100%.
Why are they not even mentioning it? Was she pretending to be Talia? But clearly that was Talia before, because Superman rescues her when she gets thrown out of a plane by the new Leviathan head who stages a coup. And it was all very – that was all very strange. But I liked it.
I started it and I clicked the thing. I was like, how many pages? 79 pages. But for the most part, I was really enjoying myself. I think I'm very similar with where you are. We were talking about high level writing.
Mm-hmm.
The writing on the Superman parts, you know, that Bendis is doing I'm impressed. Even like, I think he's a good writer, but I was like, he's got something going on here that's really interesting. His character work is.
He's been reinvigorated by going to DC.
Yeah, I mean, but the bits, the sort of conversation with the, I don't know her name, the woman who doesn't, they don't say Superman or whatever, those characters are very new to me.
Yeah, well, she's a new character. She's the head of, she's the secret crime boss of Metropolis. She's a great character.
The style of characterization, the way that they speak, their motive, all of it is very not what I'm used to in comic books, and it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
A different type of character, and we see so many archetypes of characters that, and it sort of went on for a while, and at first it was very like I you know, it was esoteric, we didn't really know what was, but it was compelling, and so I was really impressed by that. Lois and Clark's relationship is wonderful in these books. Mm-hmm. They're really good. I'm half and half on Jimmy Olsen. Honestly, I think there's a bit of bias. If it hadn't been Matt Fraction's name on it, I might have enjoyed it. But I have a level of guard up about Matt Fraction sometimes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I liked the fact, like, I know you said when the cat started puking, I was like, oh, it's that cat, which is, you know, it's the pizza dog thing. It's the same deal. Like there's these little animal characters who people gravitate towards, and so they keep bringing them back, the bat cow, the whatever. Right. You know? It's fine. I did like the over the top nature of it.
At least Bat Cow doesn't do anything. He just stands in the back chewing on cud. This is like, this is a whole thing.
But what I'm saying is, in for a penny, in for a pound. Like, they went for it.
Right.
Every shot after that was Jimmy covered head to toe in red blood. And so, if you're gonna do it like that. I'm fine. And then the other part that was really fun about it, I think the strongest part about that is, well, A, Steve Lieber art.
Yep.
In fact, every single gorilla in the background of this was Eisner-worthy. I think that needs to be noted. Like the group of gorillas watching, the facial expressions on them as they're kind of bored and kind of interested. There's at one point, there's literally, when he runs through covered in blood, there's a gorilla who literally clutches her pearls. Like, oh! there's a lot of wonderful stuff in there. And I like the fact that this is a gorilla city. And then it's completely wacky, but also that Jimmy Olsen's attitude is super consistent the whole way through, where he's like, I don't know, all sorts of weird stuff happens to me, but I'll be fine. You know, it almost, it's funny because, like, it's a lot of the things that worked about the Hawkeye series.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to work even better on a character with Jimmy Olsen. Because with at least Hawkeye, I had a, like, that's not right.
He's silly and earnest, and he's Superman's pal, and he wears a bow tie, and... You know, whatever happens from the point where he runs out of the hotel covered from head to toe in blood with the cat in hand to the point where he's wearing a gorilla suit with the cat on his shoulder will be entertaining, I think.
Here's the thing, like, and I know that's what that first issue is going to be. I don't want to know that story. I want that story to be in my head.
Man, some crazy shit's happened the last couple weeks.
That's what I want. I want them to pick up from the point that he shows up in this and maybe they hint at it. They just refer to it with the battle of whatever from Star Wars, which now they've explained. The Supergirl story was this, I was like, oh, this is why I don't read Supergirl, because I hate this.
And I had been reading it, but for a little while, it's just, I don't, after Bendis and Rucka and Fraction, it had a bit of a slog feeling to it.
I know, coming back to the Superman stuff, again, I really like the characterization between the Red Mist girl and the new crime boss girl. And again, they're just very different.
Yep.
Than what I'm used to reading and sort of the villains. I love all the newsroom stuff. The newsroom stuff is wonderful in this book. It's fun. I look forward to more of it. I don't really care about Leviathan. I just want to spend more time with these characters doing those things. And I am, you know, Steve Lieber draws a book, I buy the book.
Yeah.
End of story.
I am looking for, I mean, at the end of every DC book, they were teasing the year of the villain, which I don't really care about. But I am looking forward to sort of this Bendis-led Leviathan story.
Mm-hmm.
That will have many tentacles and many different things. I'm looking forward to that. I mean, obviously, Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen comes out in July, and Lois Lane comes out in July. So it's starting, you know, pretty soon. And I'm looking forward to it. And if you got guys like Rucka and Fraction, and if you're going to do a Lois Lane book, then Greg Rucka's your guy to write it.
Yes. Yeah, that'll be fun. It'll be fun to have him back for a little while. Oh, Mack Weldon. We are nothing if not enthusiastic supporters of this sponsor.
That's true. True.
We can generally tell you that Mack Weldon, in our experience, is better than whatever you're wearing right now. Mm-hmm. It just is. It's a higher quality product that performs its function very well. They have premium men's essentials. They believe in smart design and premium fabrics and simple shopping. It's nice and easy to go on the website. You're not going to get lost. There are not endless trees. Everything is divided in the way it needs to be. You can find what you need. Lots of colors, lots of size options. A lot of products now have started showing up for sure. They will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies and sweatpants, and more that you will ever wear. I got an email. I got a marketing email from them the other day, and it was about their sort of breathable summer stuff. And I made sure to not – I was like, I'll save that in my inbox. I'm going to go through with those and really check things out, see what I can do. Because it's going to get hot, and apparently it's going to just keep getting hotter. So
you might as well have comfortable, breathable clothing while you're dying in the inferno apocalypse.
That's right. There's the silver underwear and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial, which means that they don't stink. That stuff in bacteria that makes them smell bad cannot live there, and therefore they stay fresh. It's wonderful. They want you to be comfortable. If you do not like your first pair, you keep it, and they will still refund you. No questions asked.
Yeah, I mean, in the last week, I've worn, in addition to the underwear, both the pants in various situations. The sweatpants, as we talked about, are great loungewear pants. It's great for, you know, binging Deadwood, as I've been doing for the last couple of weeks in preparation for the film. And the outerwear pants, these premium-looking travel pants, are great for running errands, going to the gym. You know, if you're in an all-day situation with the one thing about those pants is they have a really comfortable elastic waist, and I keep forgetting that they're not like sweatpants. So I keep trying to pull them down like sweatpants, and the button keeps going, ow!
You're taken by surprise by the comfort.
Yeah, because they're so comfortable, you know, and they look great. You can walk around all day in them and not feel schlubby. It's in comfortable.
I'm not gonna lie. I was wearing my sweatpants the other day. Caught myself from behind. I was like, my butt looks good in these. That's a real thing that happened. I had that thought for a second. I've done yoga in them.
Yeah, there you go.
I've done many things. I did yard work in the Radius pant. And then you just kind of brush them off. You're good to go. They're good. It's a good product. Is what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
So for 20% off your first order, visit mackweldon.com, enter the promo code iFanboy at checkout. That is a significant discount. You'll appreciate it. It is worth your time, money, and attention to go check that stuff out. And there's no way you don't enjoy it nearly as much as we do. You just don't. So thank you, Mack Weldon.
Also worth your time, money, and effort is X-Men Grand Design, that series. This is the latest issue, Extinction. Number one from Ed Piskor continues his quixotic tour of the history of the X-Men. Don't know why this is happening or doing. I'm sure he must love the X-Men as much as he loved doing the history of hip-hop. I love this book, even if we're now entering the really rocky period of X-Men history. The late 80s, you've got the Australia years, the Marauders, Mr. Sinister.
That's when I came into comics, and I've never gotten into X-Men as a result.
Yeah, I mean, if you came in here, I can totally see why. This is, you know, post the Claremont burn, golden years, you know, post, obviously, the original Kirby Stan Lee stuff, and we've entered this sort of the punkier, rougher, this is the Storm with the Mohawk, and Longshot shows up, and Dazzler, and, you know, this is like deep cut X-Men stuff at this point. I wasn't reading the books at this point. I had... Late 80s, I would dabble in the X-Men. It wasn't until Jim Lee came along in the 90s where I really started reading X-Men regularly. So it was fun to read this because, again, I haven't read all these stories. So this gives you – I mean, when this is all over and done with, how many things can you say that you can hand someone this whole thing and be like, you will know all you know about this family of characters by reading this series. It's a really amazing overview that he's doing.
You can go toe to toe with iFanboy co-founder Ron Richards.
Well, maybe. The distillation of the history is really quite something in Ed Piskor's style, which is, you know,
yep,
incredible. I really like this book. If it hadn't been for, I thought about this as pick of the week, but it just didn't have the emotional pull because I hadn't read these books as the other ones that I had read.
So we ended the Hunted storyline over an Amazing Spider-Man.
Did you feel like it ended abruptly?
I feel like it needed to end. So I was fine with that. I mean, didn't have that feeling. I see what you're saying, I guess, but it hadn't occurred to me.
I'm not throwing my stake in the ground on it. I'm just trying to figure out if I feel that way or not. Because it felt like the buildup was such... Because this is part six, but we've had all the side issues. We've had those HU issues. So it's really more like part 10 or 11. So in that sense, it's a big meaty story.
But also, there was a cliffhanger left at the end, too, where, you know, like, the other... No, was there not?
So this story ended much like the original Kraven story, in which a spider must kill me, and so he must be killed by the spider. So Kraven dresses up in the Spider-Man costume, and his son beats him to death.
Right. So there's still the son, though.
The son's still around as a villain.
Right.
But
so that's what I mean by cliffhanger. Like,
there's still a Kraven out there, just not the Kraven who has died before. Clearly, he died. He shot himself in the head in Kraven's Last Hunt. So
right,
and he came back.
I have to admit, I've never read Kraven's Last Hunt. Mm. Like, having recently talked about Daredevil Born Again, that is another one of my blind spots that I just never read.
I like this story. We've talked about it a bunch. Yeah. I ultimately liked it. I felt like maybe it's because the confrontation between Spider-Man and Kraven only really happened in this issue, so it felt like they were building up to this thing that only happened, you know, in 20 pages. But I liked it. Ultimately, I thought this was successful.
I think there was definitely a moment, and I think I know what you're talking about. It's around the time when, like, he gets freed from his little cage thing, and then I was like, "Oh, we're through here. You know, we're gonna be done in a moment." And that's where I feel like it felt a little abrupt.
Now, also, maybe the story, even though it says the conclusion, maybe the story's continuing because the next issue cover is someone that looks like a Kraven sticking a knife in the mask of Spider-Man. So.
Right.
Maybe the Sun story continues. I don't know. I have enjoyed this. I just felt like the main Kraven story may have ended very abruptly for me, but I could be wrong.
Yeah.
I'm willing to be wrong.
Like, I don't want this to go on for the next story to also be Kraven. We were having some fun. We were moving along before. I don't want to just keep doing this.
Mm-hmm.
The War of the Realms, War Scrolls number 2. I had forgotten what the issue prior to this was until I opened it. I was like, oh, it's this little anthology.
Mm-hmm.
I liked this for the most part. I like for whatever reason, the Daredevil story, which on the surface should be stupid, I really like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you asked me about it, I'd be like, no, that's terrible. But it's kind of so wacky that it totally works for me.
Well, yeah, him fighting Kingpin. Kingpin has basically a Norse hammer, and Daredevil has the power of the gods, so they have an epic god fight.
Yep.
In front of the cameras as... Kingpin calculates so that everyone will see him in the news defending the city as the mayor when he's really just trying to cave Daredevil's skull in with the hammer. It was a smart twist.
I really dug that story. My only complaint is that Kingpin doesn't look like Kingpin. He's way too skinny.
He looks like, what's his name from the TV show? Vincent D'Onofrio.
Oh, yeah.
Not in the face, but in the body type.
He just like, having just read Born Again, I was like, make him huge. That's,
he just looks like a heavy dude.
Yeah. You know, the Doctor Strange stuff was really fun and good. I it was fun. There's little fun stories, and then finally you had the I want to say the Young Avengers story, but it's Wiccan and Hulkling, and it's a callback to their relationship with Loki when Loki was a kid in the Young Avengers that I want to say Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey did.
I think so.
Is that right?
I think so.
And I was like, oh, that's a really nice connection to these characters and a way to do it. And then the sort of subtext of what was going on there was a really nice little psychological thing about Loki that I thought was really cool. Also, there was an Adel Dazim joke, and that made me laugh. And I said, somewhere a gay man wrote this, and I looked it up, and I was right, because I think only me and gay men remember Adel Dazim jokes, but that's one of my favorite things that's ever happened on television. But it's a really good story, and it was fun. Well, I liked a little anthology as a thing. Instead of having like a whole miniseries about some side event, just do a couple of little things and even have them continue like this serialized. I thought it was cool.
I feel like reading the War of the Realms books is sort of akin to being in a blizzard. They're just constantly dropping on me. And I'm like, do I read this one? What is this one? Have I been reading this one? Did I like this one? And I'm just sort of like reading as much as I can and trying not to drown.
And you grab a thread. You're like, oh, right, this. Okay, cool. And then you grab another one and you try to, you know, attach context to that one.
And I want to point out, I'm enjoying them. I just feel like they're, every time I turn around, five more have appeared. And I'm like, where did these come from?
Well, I mean, it works in the context of if this is a, you know, the War of the Realms and they're all over the earth and doing whatever, there'd be a lot of stories.
I need an assistant who just keeps track of what I'm reading and what I'm not reading.
I think you're just fine at that. I have one. It's called You.
Detective Comics Annual Number 2. Side note before we get into the actual story. These annual numberings are super dumb. I realize why they put the numbers on, but take the numbers off and just give them a year. Just say Detective Comics Annual 2019. The numbers are stupid. It doesn't make any sense. They keep restarting at 1. I get why they do that for sales reasons, but then why have a number 2? It doesn't make any sense. It's stupid. It's just dumb.
Speaking of stupid, I didn't look this up because I wanted to have the moment where I could ask you.
Yeah.
This is the character
from
year 2.
Yes, it is.
The Todd McFarlane, Frank Miller.
Yeah, this is the Reaper from year 2. Batman year 2, yes. Year 1 was Frank Miller doing the origin. Year 2 was the Reaper. Year 3 was Dick Grayson.
Okay, the Dick Grayson one I remember. I remember going back and finding year 2 and seeing that Todd McFarlane drew it. Did Frank Miller also write it?
No, and McFarlane didn't draw all of it. I believe Alan Davis drew some of it. I'll look it up while you talk.
I remember seeing that it existed when I was very young and being very excited and getting it and not liking it at all. I remember that much, which happened a lot when I looked up Todd McFarlane after my initial excitement on Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah, I had the opposite. I loved it. It was Mike W. Barr wrote it.
Right.
He was a really good Batman writer. And then it was mostly Alan Davis and then some Todd McFarlane. That might be why you hated it, because he wasn't really much Todd McFarlane.
Maybe, but I was also 13, so who knows?
Yeah.
Somebody wrote in and was like, this is your pick of the week. And I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. And then I was like, ugh, this is so rote. I was so bored by it. And I don't know. I know it's a connection to sort of Batman stories from the late 80s or early 90s, but I thought the art was really good, but besides that,
listen, man, even I thought it was rote and it was fine. Yeah. It was fine.
It was super fine. Like, it's just like, make an annual be something.
It wasn't we both talked about how Tomasi is doing a really interesting and fun story in the book. The main book, but it's just the fucking book.
Another reason I was looking forward to it.
And so I'm not writing it off as the creative team. It's just like, it was fine. It was a Batman story. It was a callback to year 2. Again, another old story that they're claiming happened in the 5 years of the New 52. And it was fine. You know, I liked, my favorite bit was Bruce acting as, because I read it right after Superman. So Bruce successfully acting as the foppish billionaire playboy at a Bilderberg, symposium. And that was fun. And I thought the girl was going to go somewhere, but she just sort of disappeared from the story and never came back.
Yep.
You know, the bit with the autograph guy was funny. Like, it was, there were good bits in here. It wasn't bad. It just was like, okay, I finished it. I was like, that was fine.
But for the story, the mystery, the adventure part was just like, all right, it's just another one of these, which, you know, I guess that's what Batman is a lot of the time. But
yeah, it was fine. I mean, the art was good. The Stephen Moore art was good.
Yeah, it really was.
He's been one of the guys that had been drawing Nightwing. I don't know what happened to him. Yeah, it was all right. It was fine.
Let us move along to the book which is imposed upon us.
The Patron Pick.
If you are a patron of any scope, we'll tell you a little more about that soon. You'll have a vote on a book that you're forcing us to read. I'm putting these in negative terms, aren't I?
You are.
It's just, it's coercion. It's, I mean, it's, we've invited it. But basically, it's a true democracy. Whoever gets the most votes, that's the book you read, and unless it's a case of a tie, which will be solved instead of reading 1,000 things by a coin flip from now on. Yep. But the clear winner this week was Killer Groove number 1 from Aftershock Comics.
Aftershock would be awesome.
Yeah, post-shark. Smile, you son of a bitch.
That's like somebody with like one leg, and he's got the best stories at the bar because he's Aftershark. Me life after the shark. Arr.
Story by Ollie Masters, art by Owen Marin, colors by Jordi Belair, and letters by Hassan Atsmani Alhau. I got that wrong at the end. He does letters for all those really good Dynamite books we've been reading lately. How would you describe this book? What would you say the
plot?
or the pitch is?
70s LA music scene. That's it.
Early '70s.
Because I don't know anything else. That was part of my main problem, was that there's just not enough here to know what's going on. A burnout guy who had gone to LA to become a rock star with really strange hair ends up caught up in a murder in an alley behind the club. I can't give you the easy synopsis because they don't really tell you a lot. There's like two or three things happening here, and you don't know how they're related. But there's this guy, this rocker who gets caught up in a mystery. There's this woman from the bar he works at who he likes, who's a private investigator, who's taken the case of a missing father. And then there's her father, who in the opening scene, a bunch of guys in ski masks and machetes try to kill him. He, despite being an elderly man, jumps out the window into a pool and escapes.
All right.
Three disparate things that are happening. Obviously, they're all related because the people are related in some way, but there isn't like a through line.
So what Connor has just done, sort of by design on my part, is elucidate the problem with this issue.
It's Wait, before you get into the problem, I just want to give it credit for not having monsters, aliens, zombies, demons. Mm-hmm. It's just, so far, appears to be a pure crime story, which I give it credit for.
Yes, and on the surface, based on the premise therein and the things that you just said, I should have been very excited about this.
A music scene, 70s LA, crime. Mm-hmm. It's got all the high-level hallmarks of a book that we are going to both love.
This book, it's all premise. There's not a clear story here.
Yes.
And that is the problem right away. It's not a good first issue.
No, it's not.
Because at the end of it, I don't really know who anybody is or where they're going or what they want.
I did like the art.
I liked the art a great deal.
Yes.
However, I think there's a design error on the musician character.
Yes, it's distracting.
I think and it might be that he just looks like he's wearing a lady's wig.
Yeah, so he's an Italian guy from Brooklyn. He has black sideburns, black mustache, black stubble, but like a feathered blonde haircut, and it's
like
weird.
I don't know if he's supposed to be a loser or he's supposed to be like who's the Coen Brothers movie, Oscar Isaac? You know, like a talented. I don't know, because I don't know what the signals are trying to tell me.
And it's hard because you can't actually hear him sing in place. You don't know if he's any good. So
yeah,
no, you're relying on the story cues to tell you. And he first, you see him playing in a bar and no one cares. You think, oh, he must suck. And then he says, well, he almost had a hit. But that could just be his opinion. But then later on, I think someone's like, your song's really good. And it's hard to say without actually hearing it. It's hard to say if he's good or not. And you get the sense he's not. He looks like this old schlubby loser with a weird... And I kept waiting for the wig to come off. I was like, when's this wig coming off? Because it's clearly not his real hair. But I guess it is.
So it might be that they're taking advantage... It might be that these are the visual signals they want to send. But it made it kind of muddled for me. So I didn't know. And again, it's the first issue. So I need to know who to root for in a certain way.
Right.
Or at least I need you to fool me into thinking I need to root for a person. Right. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to be the person I'm rooting for, but I have to think somebody is worth rooting for. And I didn't have that. My complaint, I'm sorry. I hate doing this with indie comics. Or it's not really indie, it's published. But, you know, it's creator-owned. Somebody's did their thing, and I don't like to rip it apart. But, you know, that's – like, at the end of it, I was like, I really want to like this, but they didn't give me anything. Then you've got the private investigator girl, a.k.a. Jessica Jones, a.k.a. every other Greg Rucka character.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it was Stumptown. I was like, this is really – she's slightly haggard. She's tired. She's at the – you know.
She's a drunk.
Yeah, and I really – and I was immediate – like, her office even looks like the Stumptown. Like, come on. I know you like those kind of characters. You have to do something slightly different. That being said – so
let me add one more thing just before you get to that point. Is we talked about this with another project. I don't remember what it was, but if you are going to set it in a specific time period, take advantage of that time period. And this didn't feel like the 70s other than the guy's weird hair.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't. I had no sense of the 70s here. Not that I have a lot of sense as a human, because I was only briefly alive in the 70s, but it just didn't – if you didn't tell me it was the 70s, it could have been right now. And it's not because the 70s are back, because they're not. The 90s are back. But I didn't get a sense of clothing, of style, of place from
specifically it's just like somebody liked the Nice Guys and Stumptown and was like, let's make – and, you know, a bunch of stuff. Now, I think there are two really good scenes in here.
Mm-hmm.
The scene where the guitar dude comes upon – this thing that's happening in the alley behind the troubadour.
The fight.
There's a fight and basically kills a guy, stabbing him in the neck because he's coming for him. And then the other guy, like he thinks he's helping somebody. But it turns out the guy that he then goes has coffee with the other guy who seems to be a hitman.
Yeah.
And there's a really interesting conversation that takes place there where you think one thing is one thing, but it's not. It's another, which all makes the appearance of the guy problematic. Like I don't know who he is well enough to make context of that, but that's a really good scene. Second scene that was really good is the little girl coming to the private investigator.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much that whole conversation and everything that happened in there I thought was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
and unexpected in a lot of ways. So there's two really strong scenes in here. The rest of it I don't know what to make of.
Mm. Yeah, it was weird.
The colors are beautiful. I know it's Jordy Miller, so it's not, but like it's good. That's the most 70s thing about it. There's a hue to it. Mm-hmm. That makes me feel like, you know, dirty Los Angeles before it got shiny.
Right.
You know.
Let's do ratings on Killer Groove number one. Ratings out of five. Ratings. Tough one. Tough one.
2.5. And that's... there's promising things in it.
That was where I was going in my head as you were talking earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's... that's fair.
Yeah, I think it could very well be that these creators, you know, Ollie Masters, will figure out his story strengths eventually, and then these things will come together. There's elements here that are worth it, but this was a little bit of a mess, I thought.
Well, there you go. Patreon.com/iFanboy. That's where you can go sign up and vote to add a book to the rundown. It's also where you can go involve yourself in many things. We have Hangouts. We have a Facebook group where there's lots of discussion going on. There's lots of benefits to being a patron, as well as your superpower, which you're going to get in a second. Why go to patreon.com/fanboy? That's the best way you can help us out directly, keep the show going, support the show. Our next stretch goal, which we've talked about, is the monthly non-comics media podcast, as well as uploading all the missing video shows we did many years ago. There's many, many, many shows missing from YouTube. We'll put them all back up there if we hit the stretch goal. Also help us out by going to ifanboy.threadless.com. That's where you can find our shirt designs, ifanboy logo, her and Pickleek podcast, ratings, if one is Electro, GDAT, it doesn't make sense, nothing matters. Which I think is inching up on being 50% of all the sales at this point.
Huh.
Which is crazy.
It's a good shirt.
Fanboy.com/support, that's where you can help us out directly via PayPal. If you want to just throw us a donation without becoming a patron or buying a shirt, which is totally fine. And fanboy.com/Amazon, that's where you can find all the books we talk about in the Booksplode, as well as a general Amazon link. And we thank everyone who does anything to support the show. We do appreciate it. It does keep the iFanboy going, keep it alive. And we thank you. And as we said, one of the benefits of being a patron, if you give it the $5 or higher level, is you get your own superpower live on the show. And we're inching ever closer to the end of the list. Anyone who is wondering where you are. We are, I would say we're around the home stretch. So there's still a ways to go, but we can see the end. So keep just, patience is a virtue.
So Ben Wild,
mm-hmm,
can peel any piece of fruit in a single motion, resulting in one piece of peel left over.
Okay.
Peelable fruits.
It's not like the swirling orange thing. It's just like there'll be a complete orange shell after the
peel. No. It could, the swirl is there, but at no point is it broken. It's fast. It's efficient. You know, he doesn't have to start the peel over again. Once he starts it, it's one motion.
Mm-hmm.
And then resulting in one final peel.
Mm. No matter what.
With the orange, a lot of people have worked that out. With the apple, it's super fucking impressive.
I also had a fruit-based one I was going to save for the end, but I guess I'll do it next.
Sure.
You remember Gold Balls?
Vaguely, yes.
From the comics, who could manifest golden balls and use them as weapons or whatever.
I don't know who created that character, but they know it's funny and they're still laughing that it exists.
Gold Balls can do that with gold balls. Joshua Lincoln Nelson can manifest mini watermelons. not the big oval ones, but the small round ones that are like the size of like a big softball.
You answered my first question.
Yeah, so the mini ones. And he can throw them.
Or seated?
Oh, no, they're seated. But, you know, they can be tossed as weapons. They can fill spaces. They can just, if you're hungry, you know, you need some hydration, he can manifest the watermelon for you.
Do you like watermelon?
I like watermelon as a juice. I like the juiced watermelon. I like cold-pressed watermelon juice a lot. I don't necessarily like eating watermelon, yes.
I don't like watermelon.
When you mix cold-pressed watermelon juice with champagne,
uh-huh,
you get drunk, but you don't get hungover. Because you're hydrating while you're drinking, and it's terrific. It's the best kind of thing.
The other day in the supermarket, I handed my 5-year-old son, who's quite small, a full-size giant watermelon. I was like, here, hold this. And he was like, ah!
Did he fall over?
No, I didn't want to pay for the watermelon. It was very brief. It
would have been really funny if he'd fallen out of frame.
Yeah. It turns out the world is not in frames or not. I guess your field of vision, but it's not as clear cut as like a movie where I frequently say that one of my favorite things in the world is an off-screen tackle.
Right.
A character appears from just out of frame to take out a character in frame.
I watched Hawaii 5-0 for about 3 seasons longer than I should have because they frequently use the off-screen tackle. My sister and I would watch it and she'd go, he's bulldogging him.
J.J. Abrams is famous because he does that, but just with a bus.
Right, the off-screen bus tackle, which is a level up from the regular tackle.
It's sure, but I'm always on alert now. The whole Force Awakens, I was like, oh, shit.
When's the space bus coming?
Space bus. Adam can make the problem that someone is having appear at the time that it needs to be diagnosed. Bringing the car in, and then it doesn't do the thing that you brought it in to have them repair.
I understand. So when you take your computer in, you're like, it's doing this thing, but you open it up and it's not doing the thing anymore, but you take it home and it does it again because there's the same thing happened with me and I went to the doctor because my thumb was hurting, but it magically stopped hurting when I went to the doctor absolutely. I know what you mean.
So whenever it's time for the thing to be diagnosed, be it your computer, your vehicle, your body, if Adam is around, he projects an aura that makes that thing happen at the time that you need it to happen so that you can get treatment. We're just not seeing her right now. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, like my car's making this noise. Well, it's not making it now. Well, it's going to make it on the way home. I'm going to bet you all of the money in my wallet.
Not a problem around Adam.
Arcadia Corrigan. So Arcadia Corrigan can self-tan.
I hope that's her real name. That's a wonderful name.
So, like, you know, if Arcadia is a woman or man, whoever, Arcadia wants a little bit of tan, but doesn't want to go out in the sun, can darken the pigment in the skin, can lighten it if it's the tan's no longer appropriate, can control the deepness of the tan in Arcadia's skin.
As related to what the person of that skin tone would normally the
right,
range
like yeah, like I want a little bit of a tan. It'll, you know, give me like a I've been out in the sun 6 hours tan, and then she
internal melanin adjustment.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay,
internal.
I bet she sleeps well. Also,
right, and doesn't need to go out in the sun. Don't have to worry about.
You still want to take those vitamin D pills? Melanoma,
absolutely. So there you go, Patreon.com/iFanboy. That's where you can go get your dumb superpower. We thank everyone who does that. We have a lot of fun doing this. It's going to be sad when it's over. We went long.
Yeah, we did. We should probably stop and then save at least that first question. I want to answer that.
We will save these questions that we had picked out for next week. A lot of good questions this week. There was an influx of questions. I had a plethora to choose from, so thank you. Keep them coming. Contact@fanboy.com. We see them all.
We do.
And we appreciate them. So we'll get back to those next week. We won't go as long on the because there was so many event books or big books that we talk about. We went long on them.
Yep, and they were long. Sorry. So that's not our fault. Out now. This past week, you will have received a new book explode thanks to the patrons. Mm-hmm. As always, Connor and I talked about Daredevil Born Again, which I had never read, and he had not read in long enough that he didn't really know it.
Yeah.
And spoiler, it's quite good.
It's quite good.
It's actively affecting my take on things I'm reading now. I'm like, well, shit. Well,
this was a poor week for Daredevil issue to come out. poor timing on their part. Not that they really can't concern themselves with our publishing schedule, but it was a rough contrast.
Yeah, we chose not to do that this week. It would have been too ugly.
So next week, X-Men Dark Phoenix comes out, and I guess we'll do a show on it. Like, none of us want to really see it, but I was thinking about it, and like we've talked about all of the X-Men movies since. One of our first big special edition shows was the X-Men Last Stand show. So I feel like we got to put a pin in the whole thing. So some form of iFanboy podcasters will talk about the film. We haven't figured out what Voltron that will be yet, but someone will talk about it.
I took the bullet on Hellboy, so I don't feel a great need.
No, you definitely don't have to. You did that for all of us. So, yeah. There'll be a Dark Phoenix show. Who will be talking about Dark Phoenix? I don't know yet.
Go over to ifanboy.com. You can find all the podcasts that we did, like those other semi-controversial movie shows.
People got real mad at us for not liking X-Men The Last Stand, and I think we were vindicated.
I mean, I think so, too. I'm real mad at me for my review on that Superman movie. I like to do some do-overs in that way, but not X-Men The Last Stand. That's still terrible. It's probably even worse now.
Yes.
You can do that. You can find out what the pick of the week is before the show comes out by liking facebook.com/ifanboy or following ifanboy on Twitter or being a patron. That's there. Also, you can go to @ifanboycomics on Instagram, where there's the best of the week in panels and some other things that we find that get passed around there. And you can follow us individually on @JFlanagan on Twitter and Instagram and @CSKilpatrick on Instagram, especially if you like old movies.
And if you like the show, write a review on iTunes or leave a star rating. Even if you don't write a review, you can just click a star rating. It takes 2 seconds. That's for our show or any podcast you listen to. I went and I rated the David Tennant podcast because I enjoyed it quite a bit. Any show you listen to, it does help people find podcasts. If the more ratings, the more reviews, the better they do in the algorithm, and the more people find them, and that's the easiest way you can help a show you like, any show. And even better than that is tell your friends about it. Spread the word. Recommended review. You know, people who are personally recommended tend to check things out. So we do appreciate everyone who talks about that. And whenever we see it on social media, we're always thankful. We appreciate you helping spread the love as our street team, because there is no marketing budget. So until next week, when we will get to the emails and I guess talk about Dark Phoenix, I am Connor.
I'm Josh, and I'm talking about Dark Phoenix.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.